everyone. Thanks for coming. I want to make clear the first thing. We're not here to glorify war, to say what a fantastic thing it is and everyone should go off and do it. We're definitely not saying that. From my point of view, for the most thing, anyone who's been in the Mitch will tell you it's all about your mates. And that's as far as it goes. Everything you do, not for Queen and Country, you probably heard it on TV, they're starting to catch up with it now. You're doing it for the blokes next year, or the bloke that's come along behind you. It's all about your mates. You're making decisions on a day-to-day basis that might affect their lives. You might just have a slack 10 minutes and not bother to do a job, and it costs your mate a life. And you live with a tremendous amount of grief afterwards. You can end up living with a tremendous amount of grief just by watching something, not being able to do something. I was a combat medic. And you can't always get there on time. You do your very best. You get there and the fella's already dead or whatever. But you still live with the grief afterwards. Coping with it in the military is great because you've got your mates around you. It's a big coping strategy. If somebody goes, no matter what the circumstance is, there's usually a bit of a drink after. It's the British way. It's what we seem to do. And you make Bill Withers' song, Lean On Me. We made that last for 4 hours. We couldn't find the end of the song, really. We was drunk. But that's the sort of send-off that we're looking for. If I go, that's how I want to go, with your mates. We come into Civvy Street. You haven't got that same imperative there. With the military, it's life or death, because it's the blunt end of the political incentive. If the politicians can't get their way, they send in the gunboat or whatever. It's life or death. There isn't that same imperative in Civvy Street, but you can't turn that switch off. So you want to see a squad you're putting up a shelf. It lines up sandwich kit, there's screws, there's different types of screws, there's things to, if anything goes wrong, into the next house, you'll have some mortar and some bricks laid by. It'll do so much of a job, and you can just picture the poor on the wife sitting on the side, got to pull up with this. And this is how the squad will do jobs, or not do it at all. So there's forms. If you've got a pay query in the military, you phone up, you make one phone call, and it's sorted. You can phone in Civvy Street. If you phone on a Friday, say after 12, they'll promise you something, but you won't get any action. You've got to phone in again. I've worked in Civvy jobs, and I've heard people answer the phone. I would have worked in child protection. Answer the phone. Yeah, okay, we'll do that now. Go home, and they say, if it's really important, they'll phone back on Monday. This is a family in crisis with kids. It's a big letdown for the military mind to come out to see how much effort people don't see. People do put in effort, but when people don't put in effort to do the job properly, but let other people down, to us it seems magnified. It might only be one person in 100, but you have to squad your mind, and you'll probably think, well, it's everybody. If you go to an organisation, you meet one person, and that one person you meet really gets up your nose, there's a bit of a thing there for blaming everybody for the same sort of mentality. That's what we find. We don't trust Civvy Street. We don't trust the systems. It's a bit of a shame, because a lot of us find difficulties in this is how we live. A lot of us find difficulties in trusting things, so we go to an organisation to help, and we get messed about with the paperwork, and squaddies don't go back. There's that squaddy pride. We're working at the moment to try and push charity benefits out for soldiers. Anyone that served more than one day, or the British forces, Commonwealth, anyone helping our effort in whatever war, they were talking to benefit small military charities. I've been around Coventry, I've seen chaps there, different shoes on, holes in the knees of his trousers, the shirt's wrong. He's trying to keep himself together. And I say, look, mate, we've got some stuff for you. It's not going to affect any pension. We can save it for those that need it. But you know, this poor old bugger's got nothing. Save it for them that need it. That's the battle we're up against. There's a lot of squaddies sitting at home. They won't go out of the house. They're frightened to go out of the house. You know what it's like. If you know that there's some kids outside making a bit of a noise, you know it's kids making a noise. If you've got your curtain shut and you hear that same noise, your head fills in the gap. It's your sense of survival. That's what's kept us going as a species. You fill in the gap, you go for the negative. That might be a threat to my premises. And they withdraw further into the house. So you see squaddies haven't come out of the house in a year or so. We're trying to get them out, to get them involved, to get them engaged. Because you've got blokes 25, 30, housebound. Nothing physically wrong with them, apart from the fact they've just fell off the edge of the system. It's not true with everybody. Not everyone that comes through the military will suffer PTSD. There was a combat stress advert. I don't know if it reached TV. It was a little bit too gruesome, probably. The guys that do 22 years, towards the end, they tend to be a bit nearer civilian life. You're not Well, I think Vin, who's left the army last month, he was military right until the end. Whereas, like, our boss, Len, was Sergeant Major. And his last couple of years, he was like a family's officer. So he's in service working with civilians, so he got to understand the system. He didn't find the problem. So not everybody gets here. I've forgotten what was on about these. On one of these, I'm having a shower, so I'm all you know. There's nobody here under 8. Oh, there is. Oh, yeah, I've gone. One of the things about military life, it's the sort of thing you see going on here. You get to play with rifles. These things, weren't they? Come on, earphones. You get to play with this sort of kit. On a daily basis, it's a normal job. If you're a plumber, you worked in IT, that's your normal system. In the army, the military, it's big bits of kit. As your daily environment, it's what you get used to. When they strip that away, well, not they strip away, you decide to leave when you go, there's no... You've got a job and you thought, it's not that important, I'll, you know, become a postman, maybe, whatever the job is. It's not that important, no one's going to die if they don't get these letters. Whereas the last job, it was all about this. You're all action all the time, they've got to keep you going, they've got to keep you sharpened on an edge. You've got the coiled spring ready to go. So every now and again, the soldier goes into town, has a few beers. He's been training for months, waiting to deploy. And it takes something silly to set him off. So he wants to fight half of Aldershot. So then he finds himself a prisoner in the system. It's definitely, if you're a big people, that's where you're going to go. I mean, we're not making excuses for the chaps. But there's a certain level of preparedness that people have to stay at. You've got to be head right in your head and your body. Because when a lot of this sort of stuff kicks off, it happens that day, although it takes to cover quite a few times. I mean, how much help were we in Rwanda? Nothing at all. They didn't have oil, that was their thing. You don't find many squaddies get very political while they're in the system. They tend to stay, but this is Northern Ireland on the plate there. It's boys from Hereford, that was. Squaddies are not political. They can't afford to be political. They just do as we're told. Once you come out, you start to see why you do things. Like, we know the First World War started because it's Archduke Ferdinand and you're better off the shot. If that was the case, why were the first British troopmen, which 52 battalions, down to Basra? It was showing up in the news way back then. It was always about oil. But obviously we can't concern ourselves when we're doing this kind of job. That's got to be our total focus. When you're playing, but you've got to be a couple of degrees off and you can put a really big round through somebody's house. You're not going to get many smiles for that. Your eyes have got to be totally focused on the job. You cannot afford to have anything in the background hassling you. An unpaid poll tax bill. Things like this. It can divert your mind. If you might only owe a tenner. But if that tenner carries on, silly little things like that will affect people. The worst thing you've seen is probably some of the films when one of the lads gets a dear job. I've seen quite a few people get these, and one or two have took what they thought was the easy way out. The military, they're really good at it. They do protect us from civilian life, insofar as bills, unsolicited mail, you don't get any of that. Up until recently, when you were hungry, you just went and ate. Now you've got to pay for each meal. So you get this young 17-year-old, 18-year-old lads that come in, and they'll get the wage, and they'll... I'm a man now, I'm in the army. Said, oh, so you go out for a beer with the boys, as you do. But they don't know about budgeting. So now for the second 2 weeks of the month, they've got no money left for food. You've got to buy it each time. It's not given to you for free. You've got to buy it first. We can blame defensive cutbacks and such like. I don't want to get political here. If we need a military, we need a military. If we don't, we should just say, knock it on the head. You're always going to need something for the lads to do. In other societies, there's a ritual where you go from boy to manhood. I think we've decided over here it's to get somebody pregnant to drink 10 pints. That is our ritual for manhood. You know, you'd probably tell me I'm wrong. Other societies, the places that go out and kill a lion. I'm not sure yet, Dad, I've still got some Lego I'm open last Christmas. You've got to be a man, you just be here, go out and get the lion. Yeah, but Dad, you know what, it's a big step. Other people appreciate what they've got to go through to be a man. We don't. So when you get the young lads going in there sometimes, and that's beer is a cultural letdown, I think. It's good that we've got it, but there should be limits. And a lot of times for the lads, when they've left the military, we come back from operations like, wrap that one. Come back from ops, and you sit around a table and have a debrief with a beer. And after a certain time, the sergeant major will come up and say, right, you've done now, back to work. Simi Street, you all meet up, you sit around a beer. What we haven't got is sergeant majors tell us what to do. It's got to come from within. And you get used to being, I'll wait another 10 minutes if they want to do the job, they get me to go and do it. It doesn't happen. So sometimes the lads, really fit lads, quite intelligent, well-trained, professional, do nothing with their life. And some of it is because they haven't got that the same management that they used to. I'm not a psychiatrist or psychologist, but I've met so many lads now with the same kind of thing. You tell them, what is it about civilian life? Why are you a computer specialist working the guy who used to build radars for the Navy? Start off with a box of parts and decide what went where himself. He's achieving nothing because he hasn't got that imperative, that service life imperative. They can train you to be a soldier, but they don't train you to be a civilian. When you do your basic training, I bet that was quite scary when that happened. they've got to train you away from your sense of self-preservation. This big bang next door now, you're going to want to move away from it in case it happens again, because bangs can be dangerous generally. In the military, you've got to go sort it yourself, because you are your police force, you are the fire brigade, you are the ambulance, you are everything. So if you hear a noise, there's a disturbance, it's your training to go there to do. Whereas a civilian, you wouldn't really want crowds of people flooding in, because people are going to get hurt. There's a good one coming up. No. I'll hand you over to Vinny now. Vinny's experience, a lot of suits can be back. If I'm going to join the army, obviously not now, I'm too old. If I'm joining the army, I've got the careers office, and I'll sign my name, and providing I haven't killed anybody, if I'm in the army. Wait till you hear what the Gurkhas have to do. Vinny.
Thank you, Paddy. Just give me a couple of minutes to set up the computer.
You're our office IT expert. How come you're not? Why didn't you say that before you signed the contract, man? There you go.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to come down here and speak. Where I've been, what I've done, and how I went through in the army. I only realized what I will be talking about here when I had an email from Sarah the other day. I didn't exactly know what to speak, and only realized that it's about the war trauma and stress sort of thing. To be honest, Gurkhas don't go through trauma. They don't go through stress. I don't know. Probably we are built up like that. We are trained like that. But we have been in the British Army for over 200 years now. And there is hardly any Gurkha soldier with trauma or stress. But having said that, in my life, in my 22 years in the army, I saw my family going through trauma, which I never thought of until I realized when I finished my 6 month of tour in Afghanistan, and when I arrived at my house and saw my wife so thin and losing almost 12 kilo of her weight, really put me aback. So what I'm trying to pass the message here is Gurkha soldiers will not be having any trauma or whatsoever, but it could be affected to the families as well. Going back to the time when I joined the British Army back in 1990, it was a great privilege, a great day for me to join in the army. Obviously, my forefather served British Army, and I wanted to do the same, and I wanted to follow their footsteps. But I didn't join the army to go on war or to fight with someone. I joined the British Army simply to wear a very nice suit. Honestly. But that didn't last long, When I joined the army, obviously when you get something, you don't go after that. You change your ambition, you change your interest and hobbies. But joining the army was a life-changing moment for me. Obviously, joining the British Army is not easy as the countrymen from here. They go to the career center, they sign a piece of paper, and they go to the selection, and it's just a very easy process. But for the Gurkhas, it is very hard. There will be hardly less than 100 vacancies, and there will be 7,000 people turning. And the selection process is to carry 75 pounds on your back. It's not in a bag, it's in a basket, a bamboo basket. And you have to climb up the hill, which is about 4 miles like that. That is one part, gentlemen, I'm talking about. And we go through the academic side of life, we go through the medical side of life, we go through rigorous fitness tests. Even we have to fight with my fellow friend to knock him down to get me a point and get into the army. However, that 2 weeks of training session was worth for me to get up to here where I am now today. I joined 1990, started my life with Queen's Gurkha Signals, a part of Royal Signals, because I was good at education and my results were better. I was given a place into a radio operator. And then I started my career through radio operator, work on various telecommunication sector, including SATCOM detachment, and managing a SATCOM troop. When I'm talking troop, is almost about 30 to 40 people. So I've completed almost 22 years. Within 22 years, I had the privilege to serve the Queen. Furthermore, abroad, like in Bosnian conflict, Iraq conflict, Afghanistan. And I'm very lucky that I'm here standing with all body parts intact. I saw my fellow friend just beside me into pieces. And I went through almost a week or two just being sad. Either you say that trauma or what, but it was sad. I didn't feel at all that why I was there. Looking at the people, Afghani people, they would want us to get out of their country, but I didn't see the political reason behind. We were just following orders and putting our life into risk, hoping that country will be better one day. But once again, for every soldier, we wait for that 6 months to complete. We wait our life to be secure, safe, and back home. And as I spoke earlier, that, you know, I only realized how my family was suffering, how my wife was suffering. And then only I could feel the other families when their husband go to operation like Iraq and Afghanistan. And up until this Afghanistan conflict, we Gurkhas used to think that we are immortal. We couldn't die. The enemy couldn't touch us. Obviously, Gurkhas were in World War I, World War II. Not many loss of life. Lots of VCs, Victoria Cross. Not loss of life. We went to Falkland War. Nobody died. Rather, Argentinian ran away, hearing that Gurkhas are there to chop their head and make a soup of their head. So they run away with that, fearing, you know, they won't be having head when they go back home. So after Falkland, there was a bit of gap in conflict that our country was involved. And the Bosnia took off. None of the Gurkhas were even injured in that conflict. And Iraq, none of the Gurkhas. We went with the Americans at the front line, setting all the comms. And infantry boys doing all the defense, but also none of the Gurkhas lost their life. Having said that, there was one Gurkha, Queen's Gurkha engineers, Saper, when he was clearing the bomb and then he was caught into explosion. That incident was a moment when Gurkhas were came to know widely in the public, because there was some cases in relation to how the Gurkhas were treated. Because in that incident, a Queen's Gurkha engineer officer and this Sepa were lost life. And then these two soldiers were treated differently. And that was the moment when Gurkhas really came into the public eyes. And I will come back at this point later in my conversation. And then Afghanistan has been the major operation for the Gurkhas, losing almost 7-8 so far. And within my time when I was there back in 2008-2009, within the first month I lost two of my colleagues, Rahman Yubraz and Kadar Sazin Krishna Dura. Losing them beside me was really a shocking moment for me. Obviously hearing that over the radio for my wife would have been even more shocking, because again, I only felt that when I saw her after the completion of my tour, that, you know, what kind of environment or hell she'd been through. And then after Afghanistan, I didn't see myself taking any more part into the operation anymore, because I was nearly at the end of my 22 years. I was very thankful to God, either Hindu God or Christian God or Allah even, that to give my life safe and secure. And then it was the last 2 years of my life where I slowly transited towards the civilian. Obviously, in the perspective of a soldier, living in that kind of environment for 22 years, never integrating with the civilian, never knowing what kind of obstacles, never being able to claim any benefits, never being able to speak in a community like this, is a very hard, is a very stressful and depressive in one sense. For the last a month or so, I'm quite fortunate to come in contact with the veteran contact point. This veteran contact point is really important. That should play an integral part within the community. Obviously, veterans and the civilians, the military personnel and the civilian are completely two people with different mindset. We are grown and groomed to take life, and this, you know, what you do. But when we come to integrate with civilian, we find ourselves very hard to integrate. Either you don't understand what we are trying to say or what we are trying to do. Either it is too much for me that I have been following order, and this is the time you do something. So for the last a month or so, it has been really challenging for me, but I'm quite lucky to go through the veteran contact point, meeting same people like Paddy and the other, who are well before than me, settled and understood what and how to tackle. And I'm having a bit of guidance, like for a children, you know, you do this and that, and you expect this and that. It's not like, you know, in the army, that where you die for your buddy, where your buddy take care of you if you lose your leg or lose something or you know, you have a problem. But this is a completely different ball game. Having said that, I managed to secure a job with the veterans related job once again. The job I'm doing is very worth for me. At this moment, what I've found is within this country, there are lots and many veterans who are offended due to the fact they're not able to integrate and they're taking that physically and getting into offense and to prison and custody. I'm having a background noise from there. I'm now working with these veterans to bring them into understanding and, you know, develop their skills, and then, you know, get them into the employability or employment. I'm very lucky to do this job for them. And as you have seen the photo clip there, that is basically my whole lifespan from the foothill of Nepal all the way to British Army. And enjoying my life to the full. I'm very fortunate that I'm still intact